Hello, and welcome to the New Books in Music podcast. In this episode, I speak with Andrew Shulman, classical performer, medical musician, and author of Waking the Spirit, A Musician's Journey Healing Body, Mind, and Soul. Our conversation explores how Shulman found himself in a surgical intensive care unit and how he started playing there to give back to the medical staff that saved him and to give back to others. We discuss the role of music in healing, the specific aspects of music that promote healing and recovery, and how playing in the ICU improved his musical skills. Both reading the book and hearing Shulman talk about his experience in the ICU is inspiring and moving.
Hello, Richard.
Hello. Well, your book is a wonderful book, Andrew. And but before we kind of talk about the book, you were a professional musician, or you are a professional musician in New York City. And I guess before we kind of learn about what happens in the book, can you tell us a little bit about what kind of music you were performing before 2009?
Sure. I'm a professional musician since 1975, when I graduated from Stony Brook University. And I had a BA from music from Stony Brook, and actually was trying to decide whether to go on to graduate school. I was accepted into the music program at Sarah Lawrence University, or whether to become a freelance musician and move into Manhattan. And just a brief little, I think, interesting anecdote in how that worked. I wasn't sure at all, and the people at Sarah Lawrence invited me out there for an afternoon at the end of May before school let out, to spend a couple of hours observing their ensembles and some classes being taught. And right before I went into the school, as I got out of my car, I looked up to the heavens and said, Lord, please give me a sign if I should go to school at graduate school or move into the city. And when I got back to the car after this couple of hours, I was still undecided. And then as I got into the car, my head felt like it had been slammed by a sledgehammer. I realized I had a migraine headache, the first and only migraine headache of my life. And I looked up to the heavens again and said, Lord, I think you want me to move to Manhattan and become a freelance musician. And that's how I made that decision. And I was the first classical guitar major at Stony Brook University. My teacher there was Jerry Willard. And so I put my nylon string guitar in a guitar case and moved into the city. It was a wonderful experience being a young person and going into that environment. And this is 1975, which is a different century and a completely different world. This is pre-iPod, pre a lot of digital everything, I think even really personal computers. So there was a lot of places where you could play music and get paid for it. Restaurants, hotels, and then starting to get yourself into the concert circuit, et cetera. And within the end of my first year of playing little places in Greenwich Village, I landed the best working musician's job in New York. It was playing at Windows on the World on the 107th floor of the World Trade Center. And that kind of music, playing background music, was a very central part of my career for decades. And I'm very glad that I did it, because especially in a city like New York and the great places I played, the Palm Court at the Plaza Hotel and the Mark Hotel, and just really great stuff. And at the same time, it allowed me to make money, pay my rent, work full-time as a musician, and start developing my skills as a concert musician. So by the time you get into the 80s, I'm starting to do tours as a solo classical guitarist. And in the early 90s, I formed a string quintet called the Abaca String Band, A-B-A-C-A. And right from the beginning, that was a quintet. And within a year, it had the instrumentation it still has today, 8-string guitar, mandolin, violin, viola, and double bass. And when people ask, what's our repertoire, I always say we begin with Vivaldi and we end with Pinball Wizard. Which is true. Pinball Wizard has been our encore for like 15 years. And you might not think with that instrumentation on an acoustic group it would work, but it works like a charm. I mean, that's why we just kind of have to play that or Besame Mucho. But the repertoire is Vivaldi and Mozart and Bach and Gershwin and Duke Ellington and a big range, because that's the range I've always liked myself. We don't actually play Beatles music, which I just haven't gotten around to arranging that for the group yet. But Bach and the Beatles, music that I played starting when I learned to play the guitar at 8, actually that was folk music. 9 is when I began playing Bach, and 11, I was 11 years old when the Beatles were on the Ed Sullivan Show for the first time in February 1964. And Bach and Beatles especially very strong for me, and that's always been a very important part of the music I love and part of my repertoire. So again, all these years up to 2009, when I had my life really changed with the surgery that I had, I was a working musician in the fields I described, where playing sort of anonymously as a background musician. But again, I stress, I loved doing that work. And in part, it's because of the venues that I was in. And then I was also always in the concert field and made a number of recordings for the Centaur label. So always a busy musician up to that point in July.
Well, then now's the time, I think, to just maybe briefly describe what happened to you and how that really changed the course of your career.
Sure. Now, briefly for me is usually about 45 minutes, but I think that you might be thinking a little shorter than that. So I'll do that. At the very end of June 2009, I had a CT scan, which was a follow-up to concerns about my pancreas that had started almost a year before. And this scan showed something that hadn't been there in the earlier ones. The earlier ones had two cysts that they weren't alarmed about, but were a little concerned. They just wanted to follow it. This scan at the end of June showed a mass in the tail of the pancreas that four doctors looked at and said was pancreatic cancer. I had a surgery, and I'm not going to tell you too much because my book really describes everything here, but there was a surgery, and there was some very good news and some very bad news. And the bad news happened on my way to the surgical intensive care unit. I went into shock, and within a couple of minutes of arriving in the surgical ICU, I was clinically dead. And in a great hospital such as Beth Israel, with a great team in the surgical ICU, we call it the SICU, so I'll say that I'll use that term from now on. Great team, and they actually saved me. And then I'm in a medically induced coma for a week. And all I'll tell you is that in the middle of that coma, when medicine had gone as far as it could go and my wife's voice had gone as far as it could go, music then saved me again. In the middle of the coma, there was a few hours where it absolutely looked like I was gone. And my wife had an epiphany that only music could reach me, and she was right. The attending physician allowed it, and it saved my life. And I hope people are very, very interested to find out the details of that. And let me just say, read the book.
And it's a great book. I mean, it really is. Eventually, you have you come to a decision, or I don't even know if it's even a decision, but you decide, like, you have to go back to
yes.
the SICU and play music. And one, I was actually surprised that the people let you do that. So I guess I'm a little interested in sort of how you came to that decision that you wanted to do that and how you persuaded them to let you come back.
Sure. First, thank you so much for what you just said about the book, too. I really appreciate that very much. When you're in a coma, you don't know you're in a coma. That's number one. Number two, I will tell you, and this is an important thing, actually, it's slightly off topic, but an important thing to say is when you're in a coma, except for when you may be in very deep sleep, which you're not in all the time, you hear everything. And it is translated, though, there's a term called coma dreams, which are not actually dreams. It's a dreamlike state. So I have this experience of being really full 7 days, actually, of being in the coma, coming out on the seventh day when they started bringing me out. And so that when my wife comes into my bedside early in the morning of the eighth day, I had no idea that I was in a coma. I thought that the surgery had been the day before, and I thought the diagnosis that I had, which was a very deadly one, was the deal. And I had been very resigned to that, I will say, that I found peace with myself about that. And then my wife tells me this amazing news that what actually had really gone about. And then I'll just say the first thing she says is, your surgery wasn't yesterday, it was 8 days ago. That's the opening. And she talks to me for not more than 30 seconds and reveals to me some amazing stuff. And the first response to that I'm hit with is that it's the understanding of what the true meaning of the word awesome is. We use that word all the time. Awesome, everybody says awesome. It means great. You know, that's really cool. That's great. But the origin of awesome goes into very deep wonder. And it's wonder about the unknowable and the mystery of life. And I mean that very seriously. Anybody who's been through this knows what I mean. And so in the understanding how my life had been saved, to the degree that which I had been lucky, there were two things which will answer your question, which is that, of course, I understood that a payback had to happen, that you can't get that much of an unbelievable gift, the greatest gift, which is a second chance at life. You can't receive that without giving back. And the other thing is, as I describe in my book, my father had an amazing experience of his life basically being saved, not in the same way as mine, but essentially music saved his life in World War II from what was highly likely being killed or wounded, a high percentage of that. And I always believed that my father had a certain kind of survivor's guilt because he never had a way to give back. And I was very aware of these two things I just described instantly. So within 1 minute of my wife telling me what had happened, I made the decision that I had to go back to that surgical ICU. Now, the fact that they let me do it, how that happened is that the director of the SICU at that time was Dr. Marvin McMillan. And by the way, he is and I are very, very close. We are very close friends and we're very close colleagues now. And he wrote the afterword to my book, which I love. I just love that afterword. And he's a music guy. And so when I told him when I was leaving the hospital that I wanted to return there, there's a very funny thing that it's a wonderful little thing that if you were very, very, very sick and you're okay and you're leaving a hospital, doctors and nurses often use this line. It's very common. They'll say, "We are so happy that you're doing so much better. And we never want to see you again." And when Marvin said that to me, I looked at him and he agrees. I was fierce. I said to him, "But I do want you to see me again. I want you to see me back here with my guitar." And he looked at me for a second and all he said was, "Go home, get better, and call me." And it took a few months, but I did call him. And he was willing to try it. Now, the hospital, Beth Israel Medical Center, which is now, for the last 2 years, is now called Mount Sinai Beth Israel, has a very famous music therapy department. The Louis and Lucille Armstrong Music Therapy Department. And the director is a woman, Dr. Joanne Lowy, is internationally known in the field of music therapy. And McMillan said I would have to speak to her. She would have to give the okay. And she did something really remarkable, which is after meeting with me, and I played a little bit for her, it happened to be when she walked into the meeting, I happened to have my guitar out and played her ultimate favorite solo piece, which was a Bach prelude, the first prelude from the prelude from the first cello suite, which a lot of guitarists play. And she was willing to take a chance, so she said yes. And in those first few months, Dr. Lowy, McMillan, everybody, I was watched like a hawk. Everybody watched me like a hawk. But I think it could have even been the end of the first month. Certainly by the end of the second month, people saw that my life experience at that point, at that time, 35 years as a professional musician, the classical guitarist, an ideal instrument for doing this. And I had some experience playing in hospices and nursing homes before that, professionally. There's an organization called Hospital Audiences in New York that I worked for a number of years. And I just had the background experience, too, of being one of the sickest patients that ever survived in that room. So everybody concluded that I was really good at doing this. And I don't mean to say that with an ego thing, but I was a natural for doing this. And I very quickly actually became part of the medical team in the surgical ICU. I'll add here that I'm not a music therapist. What I do is not music therapy. And I have developed a specialty, which I call medical musician. I never worked with the music therapy department because it's a different approach. The people I worked with were the doctors and nurses in the surgical ICU. And it's 7 years now of doing this. One other thing I'll just add is that in terms of developing this approach, what I call medical musician, it still took 3 years of on-the-job training where I would, every single time I was in there, 3 days a week, 2 hours a session, 90 minutes to 2 hours, I had lots of questions that I had to ask. And it took a long time to really get to the point where I felt comfortable that I knew what I was doing. But eventually that happened. And I was very lucky that that SICU that I went back to, of course, was the place where they had saved my life. So when doctors and nurses have saved your life and you return, you're kind of like their kid. You know, you can ask anything. They're just, you're like the kid, even though I was older than probably all of them.
What were some of the sort of the actual medical outcomes that you could achieve, in a sense, through your guitar playing?
Okay. It's not too much of a spoiler. It's the first story in the book in the prologue. And it was the first experience I had. It was 5 months in. Before that, I wasn't really going to bedsides much. I was just sitting near the nurse's station putting soothing and healing music in the air. And we'll come back a little later what I mean by soothing and healing music. But there was an experience where I came in one day and I heard this very strange voice over all the noise that's in a modern intensive care unit, the machines beeping, all the different voices. It was a woman's voice. I thought she was Russian. And I went to that bedside, and in a nutshell, what it was is a case of a patient who had brain surgery the day before, and not too uncommon a side effect of that is for a day or so, they have misfiring nerve synapses. And they can often have to be strapped down, as she did. She was a happy misfiring synapse person, though sometimes people can be a little violent and all kinds of things can happen. She was very happy, a woman in her 70s. I was pretty sure she was Russian because I'd been to Russia on a concert tour years before, and it sounded like Russian to me, even though it was all kind of garbled. And I walked in, and several nurses were really frantic because it was a very difficult case. And she had tied down three nurses at that bedside for over 2 hours. It was really a mess, actually. And the means at their disposal of dealing with that, medication, et cetera, nothing was working. And I walked in, they saw me. One of the nurses said, a guy named Richard Spadafora goes, get your guitar pronto. Get over here pronto. We need you. And instinctively, I picked up my folder of Bach music and got the guitar out, went right there, settled down, took a look at the situation. The nurses were exhausted. The woman was actually, she was happy in a certain way, but she was crazy, you know, because of this medical condition, and talking very, very loud, very, very fast. And I realized she was actually not talking to the nurses. She was talking to people she was only she could see. She was hallucinating. I took the guitar. I had the guitar out. I opened up. Actually, it was that Bach prelude, that first. That's a great, great prelude from the First Cello Suite. I looked at a clock because I was curious if this was going to help, how long would it take? And I can tell you that it took 10 seconds to make a dramatic difference. As soon as I started playing the piece and the nature of this particular piece, how it is a very rhythmic pattern that's very flowing and grabs the attention, and that the lyricism of the melody and the middle voices and the bass are such that it's transfixing in a way. And that's what happened. She focused, she settled, and at the 10-second mark, Richard Spadafora, that nurse, gives me a thumbs up, just something like, thank God. And within a minute, he could leave. Within 2 minutes or 3 minutes, the other two nurses could leave. This woman was looking at my fingers, at the guitar, listening, focused. And I have had this experience in post-brain surgery a fair number of times, of just getting the brain balance that way and focusing the patient. That's one example. Another example, which is generally most of the time easy to do, but not always, is blood pressure. If you know your blood pressure numbers, and by the way, in a SICU, they only are interested in the first number. Is it systolic? I forget. We think of 120 over 80. They're just interested in the 120. Because that has to do with the heartbeat, more directly with the heartbeat and the muscle of the heart. And if you have a blood pressure over, I think, 140, it's very concerning. In an ICU, it's not really concerning till it passes 160, because it's a stressful environment anyway, and they filter that in. But I can't tell you how many times I have played for patients 160 through about 180, sometimes even higher. 180 starts getting very dangerous. And the right music, if that person is open to it, and they could be awake or not awake, they could be sedated, but the right music, the right sound, not any music can do it. And we'll talk more about the right music a little later, but I have so many times, and it usually takes about 20 minutes. 20 minutes is a solid number that I see coming up a lot. And when nurses and doctors see 165 and 20 minutes later, they see 125, they really like you a lot because you're helping them. If you help their patients, you're helping them. So there's blood pressure. I'll give you one more instance. By the way, I know it's like pulling teeth for you to get me to answer these questions, so I hope you don't mind if I struggle with this. I hear that laughing. The other great example with music is in pain, and how music can reduce the need for analgesics, can actually lower pain. And that gets more complicated in terms of how that works. I have two chapters in the book. The first is an anecdotal story about a patient in ICU delirium, which you go into ICU delirium primarily because of being in a great level of pain. And the follow-up chapter, I have several experts. I have a psychiatrist, and I have the head of pain management at Beth Israel, Dr. Ronald Kaplan. Dr. Stephen Quenzel was the psychiatrist in the beginning of the chapter, where we discuss this. And I can't do a short answer on how music works other than to say anybody who knows about the gait control theory of pain will understand how a music fills up the dorsal horn of the spine and then reduces the level of pain. If you're not familiar with that, just Google the gait control theory of pain. It's quite fascinating and so interesting in so many ways.
One of the things that I was really excited to talk with you about is what you called, and I'll put in air quotes, the right kind of music. And
yeah.
I'm somebody who grew up sort of in listening to a lot of music in the 80s and the 90s, so I'm a big fan of punk and hip-hop and lots of sort of genres which are not – you don't really talk about them in your book. And so I was thinking, you know, if you came, you know, to me and played Bach or even the Beatles, some of the mellow Beatles you talk about while I'm awake and feeling good, you might get an angry comment from me. So can you maybe talk a little bit about sort of why you think Bach and the Beatles, among other songs, are so effective, and then start there?
Okay. I'll preface that simply by saying that, generally speaking, the best music for somebody is the music they like the most. And because it's the year that we're in, and because most of the patients in a surgical intensive care unit are, most of them are 60 and over. So if I play Beatles, Gershwin, and Bach, it does have a lot to do with what you listen to when you're younger. However, I have found that Bohemian Rhapsody really takes care of a good 30 or 40 years of the last 30 or 40 years. So I have a few tools there, and I improvise. So I can improvise sounds and rhythms and a vibe and a feel if I need to. However, here's the interesting thing. If you were in a surgical intensive care unit, it would mean that you had major surgery and you were in not feeling great, you know, because of that very reason. And you probably have some kind of illness or something. Well, so that's an added factor to that. I doubt, and I mean this sincerely, that if I played for you under those circumstances, and as long as you liked the sound that you were hearing from me, you wouldn't get angry because you wouldn't have enough energy to get angry. And it's a little funny, but it's actually true. You wouldn't have enough energy. In fact, very few – the best music you would play for people is their favorite music, but very few people in a SICU, very few patients – actually have the energy even to want to say what their favorite is or to make a request. You find that out. I found that out very, very early on. And now I will say this is not really a spoiler. I found after a few years, because I had to bring sheet music all the time, even though I was a professional musician and had had a huge amount of memorized music. Let's say a little teaser is that something happened after my cardiac arrest and coma that I had for a while, a good long while, the inability to play from memory. Let's just leave it at that. The silver lining in that was that I brought a big black bag of sheet music every day, several different folders, and I brought all kinds of music. I got to try lots and lots of things. And one of the things that I noticed that no matter what the demographic, certain things really, really work. And here's a perfect example. There is a song by Schubert, originally voice and piano, that in his day was arranged for solo guitar, and I've done my own arrangement of it. This in German, the title is Ständchen, and it means serenade, and it's very famous. Da 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 dum, da di da dum dum. Very commonly known. By the way, now you know why I don't sing. And so, one day I started playing it. And the demographic, this is lower Manhattan. We have from the poorest to the richest. We have every race, every religion, every culture in there from all over the world. And I started playing that tune thinking, well, I don't know how wide a demographic it'll have that'll work. And I was amazed. It worked everywhere for every demographic I just described. And I started thinking, why is that so? And I talk about it again in the book a little bit, and not to go into too much detail here, but Vienna in the early 19th century was a crossroads of the world for East and West. And there are aspects of that melody that touch on Eastern music as well as Western music. And there are aspects of the harmonies that are actually very modern. the introduction of it could have been the introduction to a modern pop ballad. And there is also digging deeper in to why things work. The fact that, first of all, it's very lyrical, and even if people didn't know the words to this, which most people wouldn't know, by far 99% plus would not know the lyrics, it's still what I call lyrical, meaning very melodic, and the kind of thing, if you are awake or barely awake or in a coma where you're hearing everything, it's the kind of thing that could get you to be making music in your own head. And singing and language and music have those things activate a large part of the brain, getting your brain to work and everything. It also, let me again stick into why music works. In the same regard, we talk about the Beatles music. The Beatles actually is really already classical music. I mean, their first stuff is 60 years ago. Classical just means it continues through the generations. I had restaurant gigs where I play Strawberry Fields Forever. No, I was once playing a Beatles song. I don't remember what it was, but a five-year-old walked up and said, Strawberry Fields Forever. He was making a request. Also I mentioned Gershwin. So some of the common denominators are that, structurally speaking, any musicians listening to this know exactly what I mean. Structurally speaking, this is really great music, and it's also very inventive music. There is something called the Bach inventions, 2 and 3 part inventions. Inventiveness is one of the biggest compliments a musician will give to a piece of music. The worst thing you could say is it's derivative. Derivative is basically boring. Inventive really captivates you. It pulls you forward because you want to know where it's going, what is going to happen next. So in these three main bodies of work where I talk about Bach, and his music, especially the music that saved me, was the vocal work. And his other work is always singing, if you know how to make it sing. And the Beatles music, Gershwin music, the Schubert. And I mentioned Bohemian Rhapsody, which has an incredible draw over demographics. It's music that activates the imagination, activates the brain in very, very important ways. And by activating the brain, what I'm also saying is that the good chemicals you want to have created in your brain, serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine, which I always mispronounce, I'm sure I mispronounced it just now, all of these things, the dopamine kind of chemicals, get created in much greater quantities in the brain. They travel through your body, through the nervous system, and they bring good messages. They bring messages that it's in a very subtle way. It gives hope. One of the messages, and as one expert explained it to me, of why the music saved me in my coma, is the message upon hearing this very, very incredible, great music my wife played for me, the message that was sent throughout my body was, it's not time to shut down yet. Well, that's really, really powerful. And by the way, the last chapter of the book begins with a story where I got to play for somebody and do that with music by the Rolling Stones. I did that for a patient. And I only use that particular story in the book because that patient was at death's door in a coma. And there were doctors, nurses, and family members and friends all there in that hour when that happened with the music. So I have people who can witness to it and give witness to it and attest to it, that it was the music at that point for that person that made the difference. It's also, I guess, this is the point where it's very important to say, it's not a panacea. It's not going to work for everybody. Somebody can be in a coma and dying, and nothing is going to save them. But even in that situation, if it's the right kind of music, music is a blessing at the end. I have played for people who were in their last moments, who were dying, and they can't, this is serious stuff, and it could sound a little like I'm being lighthearted about it, but I'm not. They can't tell you that it made a difference, and we don't know we don't have a testimony for them, but it does seem it does seem in many ways, and if family is there, it certainly also makes a great difference for the family. If the family wants it, and if you know that this is a patient that wants music, one of the important things a medical musician has to know is when not to go to a bedside, when people don't want it, which doesn't happen too often, but it does happen. That's very important. Next question, Richard.
Well, I guess I want to go just a little bit deeper in the music that you play and that you identified. To me, I know Alex Ross in his books about the 20th century says the 20th century is about sort of the increase of percussion in classical music and sort of, I don't want to say it's the decrease of melody, but the rise of sort of not as much melody. And so as I was hearing you talk about the various musics that you're interested in, they seem like very melodic kind of pieces. Do you think that plays a key, that some, there's something very healing about melody as opposed to maybe other aspects of music?
Yes. So let's quickly, I want to also say with you, Alex Ross's book, The Rest is Noise,
yeah,
is a fantastic book, fantastic yeah. book. I recommend it to everybody who's interested in music. You have to take into account here that it's a surgical intensive care or a critical care unit. I also, I'm the officially the medical musician at Berkshire Medical Center one week a month, Berkshire Medical Center in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. And that's called a CCU, critical care unit, which is a mix of surgical and medical ICU patients. And so it's kind of like the guiding words are soothing and healing. So percussion and drums is, generally speaking, and there can be exceptions in percussion, by the way, but generally speaking, if you think of percussion, that's not a soothing, healing sound. It's an invigorating sound. When you think about timbre, and which is very, very important, timbre is the quality of the sound. A warm, intimate sound clearly falls into soothing and healing. Melody, I think, is very, very important, because one of the things I'm really trying to do is enable that person inside themselves to sing. It's like if you hear something beautiful and you hum along, and the reason for doing that is the more you engage the patient and the more you stimulate the patient's brain, the different parts of the brain start communicating with each other. And that's very important. There's a chapter in the book where the expert in my book is Dr. Cameron Folopour, who is the founder and director of the Brain Resource Center in New York City. He talks about that. And in the book, as you know, I mean, it's written for the layman. So these are very, very important things. The term medical musician, when I came up with it, I didn't even know yet, until it was a little bit later, that I was starting to do some history exploration of music and medicine, and found out that Pythagoras, the great Pythagoras and his theorem, who was a mathematician and a philosopher, who's also a musician, who's probably one of the finest musicians in Greece of his time in the 6th century BC. And his instrument was the kithara, also pronounced kithara, K-I-T-H-A-R-A, which is a little bit, has some similarities to a guitar. In fact, the modern word for guitar in Greece is kithara. It's a lyre, the Greek lyre, L-Y-R-E, and similarities to harp and guitar. Google it. It's very interesting stuff. There's a guy who has videos on YouTube called Peter Pringle, and he's terrific. And you can really hear why Pythagoras thought that the stringed instruments in general and the kithara was the best music healing instrument. I have to say that all the flute players in the world are going to hate me right now. Pythagoras didn't want flutes used, and he did not want percussion used. So all your percussionists, sorry. A flute can be a wonder. I happen to know, I've heard flute players doing this. I used to work with flute a lot. I will say that partly it's the quality of the type of instrument is part of what makes the right sound. But the single most important thing is the sensitivity of the player. I once had a conversation with Dr. Connie Tomeno, who's in the book in a very important ways. She is a music therapist and the director of the Institute for Music and Neurologic Function. And we were talking about this once, and, you know, she just said, look, ultimately it boils down to the sensitivity of the player. People joke with me sometimes and they say, well, you wouldn't bring a tuba into a SICU, but they're one of the greatest tuba players of all time, Howard Johnson, who I had the great pleasure of being on the same stage with years ago in an event actually that's in the book. I don't want to say what it is. If Howard Johnson sat next to the bedside of a critically ill patient, he would do wonders because he's a brilliant musician and he would know how to do it. So when talking about the right music, I'll bring this more into focus for you and say that in critical care, it is very, very important that the level of playing has to be very high level. And Dr. McMillan actually made a very good point about that. Over the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years or something, especially since recordings have been out on television and everything, most people hear most of the music they hear from professionally recorded music. And it's edited music, usually, if there are no mistakes, it's beautifully recorded, so on and so forth. And that's what people are used to. He said 50, 60, 100 years ago, most people heard the music they heard from amateur musicians because they heard it in their homes, because they played the guitar and mom played the piano and Uncle Joe played the banjo. And it was different then in that regard. But I would say that today, the playing level has to be very high, whether it is a medical musician or a music therapist or whoever is going in there. Because if it's not, it is agitating. And this I know for sure. I've had conversations with doctors and nurses that when they have the experience of having people who mean very well, but it is not a high level of playing, it's agitating. It's agitating to them, especially. It's distracting. It's agitating to the patients. So fortunately, we live in a world now with a great deal of musical talent and a great many people who play very, very well. And I'll add that Dr. McMillan and I are now at the point where we hope within this year to start giving workshops, to start training people to become medical musicians, which involves people. The starting point is we are looking for professional players, soloists. I do believe it's a solo job, not an ensemble job, because there's not much space in there, and you have to be able to turn on a dime in the middle of a piece if you need to. And you have to have a lot of empathy. You can have a brilliant virtuoso who hates people. That person doesn't work out too well in there. You have to be able to be a team player. You are part of a team, and you have to understand where you are in the hierarchy. And then there's medical training, which McMillan will do. I can do some of that at this point, but McMillan will be the medical director for doing all this stuff. And there's a whole bunch of things that's very, very important that you have to know in terms of medical things. Otherwise, you can be in a dangerous situation.
Well, I kind of want to shift maybe a slightly different direction.
Yeah.
And that is, I was very curious as I finished up reading your book about how this experience maybe has changed your perspective and even how you perform for non-medical situations. So what have you learned about performing through working in the hospitals?
Oh, you know, that's a very good question. I have to tell you, I was delighted to see over time that it just playing in the SICU improved all of my playing by a good amount. Okay. Now, I don't want to go into this thing about what happened, especially in the first 2 years, but I'll just say that being a musician in there actually healed me. I needed the hint is what happens after you have 2 minutes of cardiac arrest and you've been in brain ischemia for 17 minutes. It's not a real wonderful thing for your brain, but playing there healed me. But what I saw from the very beginning, and part of why it healed me and why it improved my concert playing, is the degree of concentration you have is much more than anything I ever saw that I need to have in my life. And I've played in Carnegie Hall and Lincoln Center and the Royal Albert Hall in London, where you have to have a lot of concentration. So here is an example of why that happens. First of all, it's a room of life and death. So the overview, the title of the chapter in the book, chapter 12, which is the overview of being a medical musician in an ICU, is called Just Don't Kill the Patient. And you'll see right in the beginning of the chapter where I got the line from. It's not from me, it's from one of the doctors. But you are very aware of that in the beginning. And for certain people, people who don't have the nerves for that should not do this kind of work. Because, and that holds true for the doctors and nurses, by the way, of people who do critical care. And I've met especially some nurses who did it for a while, and they said their nerves weren't up to it. They went into other kind of nursing situations. So this is incredible, intense concentration and awareness that to a certain degree, a person's life is at stake here that you are connecting to in that moment, and that you have to be extremely, extremely careful. Now, what you're also doing when you're playing at a bedside, it's easy to describe, it's not so easy to do, is you are watching the patient very carefully, principally their face, their hands, and their feet, because you can see a lot from movement there or expression, so on and so forth. And at the same time, there is a computer monitor over the bed that has the vital signs, which are the heart rate, the blood pressure, the oxygenation level, and the respiration rate. Some of these monitors have more than that, but those are the basic important ones. And you have to know what the normal ranges are. And then one more thing that you're doing is you have to be listening to everything that's going on around you because there could be a code blue. And they want me there at the side of a code blue. So that's when a patient is wheeled in and they're not responsive and they're usually in cardiac arrest, as I was. This is a very serious situation. You could have two doctors walk over to the bedside on a consult, and you have to hear them and you have to be very aware of them and lower your playing so that they don't have to strain to hear each other. You have to be aware of the entire room. Now, take all the things that I just said, and at the same time, you have to play the best you've ever played. You have to play as well as any concert you've ever played. Now, if you imagine doing that 3 days a week for 90 minutes or more, and you've been doing it for 7 years, obviously, this is really going to be an incredible training, and you're going to have a real upgrade from that. So by the end of 6 months of doing this, I had some friends listening to me who would say, I've never heard you play so well. And I knew it was actually coming from that. So it's a great, you know, you're giving to others, you're helping others, and you're getting tremendous amount. I always say I get much more than I give.
Well, this has been just wonderful today. Thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your experiences with us.
Well, thank you, Richard. I'm so grateful that you had me on the show.
You've been listening to the New Books in Music podcast. Today I've been talking with Andrew Schulman, the author of Waking the Spirit, A Musician's Journey, Healing Body, Mind, and Soul. This is your host, Richard Scherr. Thank you for listening.